Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Startup Sales. Really excited for today's guest. We have Beth Ayers with us today. She is on three different boards. She has her own podcast for COOs. We're going to talk a lot about, you know, how to interact with your board today and this, you know, when it comes to sales and things like that. There's a lot of good information, so stay tuned.
Welcome to the Startup Sales Podcast, where we dive into the world of sales and marketing. Join us as we interview founders and industry experts, uncovering their successes and failures in the market. Get valuable insights and learn from their experiences to boost your own sales strategies. And now, a word from this episode's sponsor. Are you tired of struggling to reach your sales targets? We believe in you get what you pay for. That's why you pay only for the leads you get. Introducing Startup Sales, the leading growth hacking agency that guarantees meetings with your prospects. With our proven strategies, we'll bring you between 15 to 30 qualified prospects every month. And here's the best part, it's risk-free. You only pay us upon success. Don't let your competitors get ahead. Let Startup Sales supercharge your sales pipeline today. Visit us at startupsales.io. Startup Sales, your ultimate growth hacking partner.
Beth, welcome.
Hi, Adam. It's great to be on. It's always fun to be on somebody else's podcast and see how it works.
You ever find that there's like things like, wow, I should do that, or I need to change the way I'm approaching it?
Well, I think your intros are just awesome, so I definitely think I have a bit to take away. Thanks.
So Fiverr, that's where I did that. Good. So Beth, who are you and why should people listen to you?
Who am I? So I have been in tech sales for more than 20 years. I've been in the SaaS space for coming up on 15. I built and grew the sales teams at New Voice Media and Peak. I'm on three boards, specifically focusing on the go-to-market strategies and help build out teams. And I know how to scale businesses from Series A to C. D, and then I get a bit bored and it gets a bit big and I want to start all over again.
And then you start over again, then you wish, well, I should have probably just stayed where it was easy.
No, it's never easy. Basically, I think it's never easy. It's just the challenges that you're willing to face and the ones that you don't really like as much.
So it's interesting. What's the biggest takeaway? I mean, if you could put it down into one thing, could you even do that, like, for success?
If a whole business into one thing.
Let's focus it then. Sorry, go ahead. Product market fit?
Yeah. Basically, like, you can build the most amazing systems and spend a lot of money and massively push into the market. But if people don't fundamentally like your product, or you're not solving a problem that people are willing to pay for, you're not going to grow a business. And it's going to be really hard work.
That's really big. You know, solving a problem. If you're not solving the problem, as cool as your toy is or your platform is or whatever it is you're developing, if it's not solving a problem, it's not going to succeed.
Yeah. Also, solving a problem people are willing to pay to have solved.
Or willing to pay at a level that's profitable for you.
Yes.
That too, yeah. Yeah. All right. And so how... If I'm a younger company, or I'm, you know, I've just started to develop a product, how do I make sure that I'm going the right way and making sure I'm getting product fit?
Listening. So I think it's really hard, and I have a lot of empathy for startup founders, because you have an amazing vision. You know where you want to go. You see a gap in the market. You see a problem. But you're also generally a contrarian. You're seeing something nobody else can see. So the first people that you speak to are going to tell you no. Everybody's going to think you're a bit weird. And it's hard to figure out who you should listen to and change, and who is wrong and just being conventional. And so you obviously need to find some people who believe in you, because otherwise nobody's going to buy your product. But you also need to figure out what is the feedback that matters and what isn't. Like, going to the whole Henry Ford thing of, if I ask my customers, they just say they want more horses or faster horses. So it takes a a certain amount of humility, checking your ego and figuring out what is the feedback that is valuable and true that you should take on board and let the rest fall off of you. I know that's not like, it's not an easy answer, because for me, at least, a lot of it comes to the feeling and whether or not you can feel that that will be helpful.
That's tough, because I think most founders will think, well, I feel this is really helpful. I feel this will be helpful once it's fully developed. But, you know, taking that line and saying, okay, like, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. How do you know that's your ego speaking versus they really don't know what they're talking about?
You have to remember that people need to be willing to part money with your product. And so if nobody's parting money, it doesn't matter how great your vision is. Like, you need to be able to articulate it and find those other early adopters who believe in what you're saying and are willing to pay for it. Otherwise, you don't have a business. You have a cool idea.
So I like that. And I think it's important also to get a normal amount of money, not to heavily discount just to get somebody on board.
Absolutely. And because, you know, we're in the world of SaaS, or at least I'm in the world of SaaS. I'm assuming you're also in the world of SaaS. I didn't actually ask that question. Okay, cool. it's not just getting them to pay for it the first time. It's that renewal. So if you think about product market fit, it's how easily can you generate leads? How easily can you close leads? And how easily can you retain and upsell? It's all three elements. And when you get the three working well, that's when you know you have product market fit.
You said something that most people don't say. And it's like, retain is, you know, that's something that most people will say that have been through this. But you said retain and upsell. And I like that, because, you know, you got to be able to grow these accounts as well into new products that you're making, or more usage of your product, depending on your business model. So can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So it's all three. It's you land and expand. So you're starting with either a small team and expanding into the rest of the business, or land and expand a small product to a bigger product. But you also early stage have an alpha or a beta. And so when you release more features, even if it's still like your entry level product, you should be able to have people pay more upon renewal, because they should be seeing more value and it should be stickier. So I'm not saying to go and double your price in the next year, because that's going to leave a very bad taste in people's mouths, but you should be able to justify somewhere between a 5% and 20% increase within your first 2 years, because your product has at least doubled in features. But you should also, your first customers are loyal to you, so you should be loyal to them. Even as you grow bigger, you know, you want people to enjoy working with you and not just be like, Salesforce.
somebody has a personal experience there.
I've worked with Salesforce for 20 years, but I still know how painful it is.
Yeah. So I like how you said, like, they're loyal to you. Your customers are loyal to you. So you need to be loyal to them. Does that only mean a discount?
No, I'm not talking about a discount. I'm talking about an understanding of where those first customers who took a massive chance on you are coming from. They've helped you shape your product. They've probably done your first investor calls. You end up building a personal relationship with them. So if you then go in on year two or year three and be like, oh, by the way, we're now going to charge you twice as much and we didn't tell you and you haven't budgeted for it, you're just not treating them very well. And it breaks that personal relationship. So I think there should be a level of respect for those early customers who took a chance on you. Their value is more than just the money they're paying you.
Absolutely. They're kind of part of the company, as you said, speaking to the investors, speaking to other future prospects that are coming on board, and they're really helping build the company. It's interesting, though, because something I come up across a lot when I'm helping companies is how do we raise the prices on our early adopters? And I'd like to hear your opinion on this, is because what I have done in the past is for my early adopters that I sign on, I tell them, look, here's the price today. Obviously the price is going to go up as we develop the product and yada, yada. But what you're going to do is you're going to get, upon renewal, it will be at the current value minus a 20% early adopter discount or something like that, that you've pre-established at the beginning of the relationship so that they know where it's going to be later on. How do you feel about that?
I think that's amazing way to do it if you have any idea what's going to happen. I think it depends on how early stage you are and being able to future plan. And I also think it depends on like the original contract value and what those relationships are. Like there's so many variables. I tend to come from more of a enterprise SaaS background rather than a high volume one. So just to kind of put in context, I am talking about where you have a lot of personal relationship. And if you're signing that first contract and they're taking a chance on you to say, this is what's going to happen in year one, where they're like, yeah, I don't even know if your technology is going to work. I think for me, getting that first deal over the line, making sure everybody's happy, but then keeping the communication going might be my preference, but that's just because I don't think I'm nearly as organized as you are in my vision for the future.
I don't know, maybe I'm just very optimistic and I believe in what I'm selling. So I know we're going to be working together in a year or 2 years, depending on the renewal date. And I know that you're going to like this. So that let's set the tone now so that we don't have to fight in the future. Because I've been there too many times. Yeah.
Totally agree. And also love the transparency and setting expectations. Nobody wants a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah, very much. Especially if you're going to give them a bigger discount at the beginning. Like that's, you're giving already, I don't like discounts personally, but I know a lot of people already give 50% off for the first like early adopters so that they could at least get the ball rolling. So it's better and easier later on down the road when you bring it up to the standard pricing.
Yeah, assuming you know what your standard pricing is, because I think part of it is also you're kind of throwing out prices, aren't you? And you're,
yeah.
And so that discount you may discover is actually the price that the market will pay.
Yeah.
Or it might genuinely be a discount. You just don't know in the beginning, unless you're displacing a competitor or disrupting an existing market, and then your pricing's much easier.
Yeah, and then you become like a commodity.
Well, it can be a commodity.
It's a different kind of sales process.
It is, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I want to kind of pivot a little bit here because there's something that, before we started recording, we were talking about that you're on the board and everything. And I think it's really interesting too. If you're on the board of three different companies, what is your perspective of the communication between the board and the founders as it pertains to sales and the pipeline?
Yeah. And interestingly, I'm in three companies at various levels of maturity. So there's definitely a different relationship for founder-led sales, no sales team yet. And you're working through, do we have enough signal to start investing in a sales team? Should we hire our first sales leader? Versus have product market fit, have momentum, have all the reporting in line, and now we're talking pipeline and forecast and sales rep productivity to the board. So which of those should we start with?
You choose.
You choose, okay. Let's start with how you know it's ready. You're ready to hire your first sales leader and what you should look for in your first sales leader and how you can use the board to help.
Okay.
I think that might. I think a first sales leader should come just pre or just post. I mean, it's so hard to say a Series A now because you have seeds that are like 5 million and you have, but let's say you have a couple million in the bank for whatever reason, whatever raise, or maybe you're bootstrapping, but you're actually at that point, so that you can afford to hire a sales leader without bankrupting you, and have enough time that if it's the wrong hire, you can last 12 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that whatever event means that you're in a position that you can now do that. You should also be having pipeline coming to you rather than it all being you talking to people. So if it's word of mouth or other customers, and you have, or you're actually starting to build out your own lead gen, you have more opportunities than you know what to do with, or you're very technical co-founders, you have more opportunities you know what to do with, and you know you're leaving money on the table because you don't actually know how to run commercial conversations or so, you're not comfortable with that.
So you said something, I want to make sure I understood you correctly, that you have leads coming to you. So do you mean by inbound only, or do you mean you also just have a good outbound strategy as well, but leads are coming in?
Leads are coming in. And also it might be earlier where it's customers referring you in. There's some level of word of mouth. You're in with a big customer that wants you to talk to lots, but you're basically at a point of capacity. Yeah. You don't hire your first sales leader because you have no sales and they're going to come and fix that for you. You need to know that there is some level of demand in the market in whatever way you're looking at it. And by not hiring somebody else, you're losing out on sales.
Especially because, as you said, you don't know how to run the sales process. So if that's the case, which it generally is, and that's okay, because most founders are tend to be technical, how do you know what kind of salesperson to hire instead of just hiring the one that comes through the door and looks the best?
So there are definitely things I think you should not hire. If you are disrupting a market or there's a big competitor in the market and they're really big, don't hire their super senior sales anything, because unless they actually were there from the beginning, because they tend to, whether or not they're disillusioned with the company, they still believe in that company's sales rhetoric. So they'll come in and they'll just be like, oh, you don't have X, you don't have Y, you can't do this. So don't hire that one. Don't hire for a black book. I have never, ever, ever seen a black book work, because they've probably just sold something. And so you're going to wait 2 to 3 years before they can sell anything again. And you have the entire brand behind you. And don't hire for the person who is 2 or 3 stages ahead of you. So if you're a Series A, you're hiring your first sales leader. Don't hire the CRO of a company, or you know, somebody who's great at Series C and beyond, because that's not what you need. You need, ideally, and these people are so hard to find that if you find one and they reference well, hire them. Somebody who has done, as a leader, your stage to the next stage successfully. The reason why they're hard to find is because, and they're very expensive, is because they know their value, and also they tend to go fractional. If you can't find that one, find the person who is eager and ambitious to do that sales leadership role, who has been in that stage, but as an early AE. So, and this is their first leadership role, but they know what it's like to start in the beginning, to work through chaos and find order.
Chaos is a nice way of putting it.
It is. It's like a big mush, and you're taking this mush and you're turning it into some, and you're turning it into a pot. I don't know, like a statue. And those are the people you need. If they're in your industry, great. Or if they're in adjacent industries, great. If you're deep tech, I think you need that more. If it's just a SaaS tool, I feel like you don't as much. And the stage specific experience matters more.
I've done it myself 3 times successfully. And I completely agree with you. And when I'm talking to different founders, one of the biggest things I come across is the same thing as you said. Don't take the VP sales from Salesforce. You know, if they're coming from a big company, the sales process is different. The sales cycle is different. They will most likely fail at an early stage startup, no matter how successful and how hard they work. It's not there that they don't want to be successful. They just don't know how in that situation.
And they don't have the resources. Like if you have somebody who comes in. So one of the things I also like is in the hiring process, asking as part of the interview process, how are you going to build your team? What's your plan for the first million? How much money do you need? What's your budget? And they should ask questions, but I'd like to understand if somebody comes in and is like a real bootstrap mentality of like, I need an SDR and a lead gen person, and this is the route to a million versus, right, so I'm going to need a talent person. I'm going to need an SDR manager. I'm going to need, and then lists out and builds this massive team in year one that's going to cost you a couple million.
Yeah.
Then you know they're not the right stage, because it might make a lot of sense, but if you don't know enough, all you're going to do is waste a couple million that you don't have to waste.
Yeah. That said, though, it's also hard because you said the bootstrap mentality. It's always hard, even though it's not my money, it's hard to spend it and you don't want to spend it. But at a certain stage, you kind of have to spend it. That's why the VCs are giving you the money. So how do you differentiate between that and where do you draw the line?
Yeah, then there's definitely a moment that is a leap of faith moment. Like I always think about the Indiana Jones 3, you know, when he has to just like, I don't know if you've seen it, take the step. Yeah. And because of SaaS and you're selling ahead and you're investing in the future, there is a moment where your numbers don't look quite right, but yet you do have to start to invest more in sales. And that's, again, where this kind of combination of looking at your numbers, listening to advisors, and knowing that it's the right moment comes into play, and you do need to take the leap of faith. So what I mean by your numbers looking right is you have some level of leads coming in. If you have hired your first salesperson, let's say you've now hired your sales lead, that they are the net addition that you were hoping for. So you are now selling more than you were by yourself. It's not the two of you going to every single meeting together, but that your sales leader can now go to their own meetings and close their own deals, where maybe you're coming in for the last bit of that conversation or the start as the validation of the CEO, but you're not in every single sales deal anymore. And that person is now at capacity.
So you like to hire more. You like to hire one salesperson as opposed to two?
Well, I'm thinking of as a sales leader. I think it depends on whether or not, if you have a commercial founder who can act as leader or does act as leader, then hiring into for the A/B testing and is it a product market fit issue or is it a person issue makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you have technical co-founders, no commercial elements, you're actually hiring in your commercial partner, I would hire that one person, see that they work, and then have them hire too.
Gotcha. Okay. That makes more sense. Where does the board come back into this? Let's go back in the conversation.
Yeah. So where you can use the board, first of all, I think it's really important to use the board as advisors and as friends, I guess, like on the friendly side, because I know a lot of times people, as soon as a board comes in, they're like, ah, it's a board, the board, the board has power, the board does this, the board can fire me, the board. And you start to have like a bit of an adversarial relationship just built on fear in your own head, because the board wants you to be successful. And quite frankly, if you have investors that build an adversarial relationship, you've not chosen wisely, and you need to have that open conversation.
A little too late for that at this point.
Well, I mean, dip it in the bud before you have this massively adversarial relationship. So you should be able to come to the board and discuss, is it time, or we have hired and hopefully it'll be fantastic. Chances are it won't, because I've never seen a company get a sales hire right the first time ever. I don't know if you have, but
I mean, it's very rare. I have seen it. I mean, without patting myself on the back too much. I was it twice. So yeah.
And your company was lucky to get you the first time. Like normally there have been a couple.
Zero to a million in like 9 months and then scale up to 5, 10, depending on the company.
But they haven't accidentally hired somebody before you and you've come in to
I was the first.
Yeah. Right, so they were lucky. Yeah. A lot of times.
But I've also come in the after the bad hires. So yeah, that's typically the case.
Yeah. So anyhow, so when that happens, because chances are it will happen, it's okay to be honest with the board, because you've backed this person. They may have flagged some concerns. They may not have flagged some concerns, but you need to be able to come in and say, I don't think we've made the right hire, need support in exiting this person, or how do we talk about it? If you have made the right hire, having them partner with the board is really helpful. And being open. Now, I think that this is something that you don't, early stage companies don't always understand this, but when you get to be later stage, all board documentation is standard part of the due diligence and investors will read everything. So you should think about what you share written and what you share in an open conversation. And I am not at all saying that you should fudge your numbers. And I'm just to be really clear, like there's, you know, but you can be a lot more open in a discussion rather than thinking about writing it all down that an investor will be a future investor will be looking at without any of the context.
I think what you're saying is kind of like keep your emotions, like if it's an emotional discussion, talk more openly about it, but don't put it on paper. You know, like, oh, I don't like this person. Maybe he's going to be a problem, but it turns out he's fantastic. And then that just creates a problem down the road.
Yeah. And, or getting into unnecessary detail.
Yeah.
That is probably emotion related.
Yeah.
There is no need to share that in the official board papers, but you can definitely provide context and then discuss those hires or what's going on in your sales. But you should also, you can also think about your board papers as a little bit of a sales document for the future as well. So when you beat a competitor, when you have a really happy customer who's explaining why you're awesome, why they want to renew, why they want to pay more, why they think your product is the best product they've ever seen, those 100% should go into your board papers.
All the wins.
All the wins, all the little bits of information. You can stick it in your CEO report. You know, if you have an inbound from Gartner because they've heard great stuff and it never goes anywhere, but it was exciting for a moment.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Inbound from Gartner, and then you found out how much money they want, and then
yeah, exactly. Oh, never mind. They were just trying to sell something.
Exactly.
But every so often, it can actually be an analyst, and that's super exciting when it happens.
Yeah. All right. That's really good and helpful information. I think that's something people really should take note of, and or not take note of. So what other advice what for the board do you have, like when working with sales?
For the board members themselves, I think that there's like for board members who are investors who have never been operators, it can be quite difficult sometimes because you don't want to step on people's toes and you're not always sure that you have the expertise to wade in. And that's awesome because it's always good to be humble and know what you're good at and what you're not good at. But what you really have is much more visibility of the market and other businesses than individual founders do, because you're sitting on loads of boards, your partners are sitting on loads of boards, and you can hear the things that are really working, or you can hear movements in the market. And you also know what good looks like. And so that is what you should be helping your portfolio company with, is intro- so in the hiring, introductions to other good sales leaders so that you know what good looks like, without worrying about poaching. Like, you do just have to be based on relationships and long-term relationships. So don't poach.
So you
anybody.
Mean just go and have a conversation, like take somebody out to lunch and get to know why, what makes them good, what to look for, et cetera.
Exactly. And I think that is just massively helpful when you're starting your own search. And I'll often see investors do that when maybe the process isn't going particularly well, or founder has chosen somebody and they're like, yeah, I have seen better. And they're like, well, before you put out the offer, why don't you have a chat with X in this other company, just so you can kind of see who else might be out there. So really use your board for that level of advice. I'm not an investor. I'm a operator, or former operator, or a little bit of both. And so it can be helpful to have non-investors in as some of your early non-execs, because we have a lot of empathy and know how hard it is for real. And then also, like, I think I've done 8 or 9 fundraises. So I have also, like, really understand and have relationships with investors. So you can use people like us to bridge the gap between the two and the understanding, and sometimes translate what an investor might be saying versus what an operator, and vice versa. And also, like, when expectations are unrealistic on a founding team.
Also, I think it's also, you know, I started investing recently, just small investing, but so that I would have skin in the game and I would understand it from a different perspective. But I think what you're saying here is it's also important to have somebody that doesn't have their own money in the game and has been more of an operator, so that you also get that opinion that they're not just worried about their investment as well.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I think it's, because I'm also an investor. I think it's the difference between, like, being an angel investor and being an institutional investor, like, where you just have, you're viewing it in a different way, maybe, or maybe I'm just not as attached to my money as I should be. I'm not sure.
Who knows? All right. Beth, I mean, we're way over time and I don't want to end the conversation. But it is what it is. So thank you very much. Beth, how could people learn more about you and reach out to you if they want?
LinkedIn is the easiest first step. I do mostly reply to my messages when I notice them. It might take me a couple days or more, because sometimes I don't notice them at all. I don't know, somehow LinkedIn works and doesn't work for me. Yeah, I think that's the easiest way. If you're interested in learning more from our podcast, it's called The Operations Room. You can find it everywhere podcasts are. And yeah, I think that's the easiest way.
Perfect. And also, just for everybody listening, Beth on LinkedIn is actually Bethany.
So if you're
going to type it in. Thanks, all right, Adam. Beth, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Startup Sales with Adam Springer. Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Contact Adam about speaking engagements or consulting services at adam@startupsales.io.